and welcome to The World Today. I'm Kim Landers. This Friday, the long-awaited final report of the Child Abuse Royal Commission publicly released. And Disney's takeover of 21st Century Fox might be good news for the Murdoch family, but it could also be heaven for fans of superhero movies. After a five-year inquiry into abuse and cover-ups at institutions around the country, the Child Abuse Royal Commission has handed its final report to the Governor-General and it has been publicly released. There are 17 volumes to this report, which contain crucial recommendations which the commissioners hope will protect the nation's children. The inquiry's chairman, Peter McClellan, flanked by his fellow commissioners, handed the report to Sir Peter Cosgrove at Yarralumla.
During the course of our inquiry, various prosecutions commenced against a number of people in the subject of our investigation. Our terms of reference require that our inquiry not prejudice current or future criminal or civil proceedings. Consequently, we provide two versions of the final report, one of which contains appropriate redactions. We recommend that the redacted version of our final report be tabled and published. We further recommend that relevant parts of our final report be published in unredacted form at the conclusion of criminal proceedings which may be relevant to that part of the report.
The Royal Commission Chairman, Peter McClellan, delivering the final report to the Governor-General. Our reporter, Samantha Donovan, has been following the Royal Commission for years and she joins me now. Samantha, the report is out. It is a massive document. What have you managed to glean so far?
Yes, 17 volumes, as we heard, Kim, plus the preface and summary. What I can see is that there are 189 new recommendations made by the Royal Commissioners. So that brings the total number of recommendations for this inquiry to 409. We've already heard from the commissioners over the last few years with recommendations on things like working with children checks, redress and civil litigation, and criminal justice. But having a quick look already today, they've made further recommendations on how to make institutions safe, also improving the way institutions report complaints of abuse and record keeping. We know that the Commission's heard a lot about the problems with record keeping and the lack of it over the last few decades. There are also recommendations for schools, and then in a separate section, recommendations for sport and recreation bodies, arts groups, and cultural and community recommendations. The Commission, as we know, covered, aside from the churches, groups like Swimming Australia, the Scouts, the YMCA, dance studios. So they've got slightly different recommendations, say, to, for example, schools. So we'll be taking a closer look at those. Also recommendations for detention centres in what the Commission is calling contemporary settings. And, of course, a large number of recommendations for religious institutions.
So, Samantha, almost 200 new recommendations, as you say, a lot to digest. All of the organisations and institutions that were investigated are going to have to go through this report as well. Have some of them been explaining how they intend to respond to the recommendations?
Yes, they have been. Frances Sullivan, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Catholic Church's Truth, Justice and Healing Council, has been speaking this morning, and he's reiterated the Church's call for the Prime Minister to immediately set up a COAG committee to examine the recommendations. He spoke to ABC Radio Melbourne this morning.
Because this is a Commonwealth state issue, the only place where those leaders actually meet is in the COAG processes. So I think the Prime Minister today should announce that they are going to establish a COAG, let's say working party, where all states, territories and the Commonwealth will commit themselves to systematically going through the recommendations of the Royal Commission. I mean, the Commonwealth Parliament having a committee in the Senate is fine for what the Commonwealth Parliament can do, or a state government's parliament is fine for what a state parliament can do. But we need now a national response, because we have just seen over 5 years the revelation of a major national social ill that has to be remedied.
Frances Sullivan, the CEO of the Catholic Church's Truth, Justice and Healing Council. So, Samantha, what has the Anglican Church had to say?
The Anglican Archbishop of Melbourne, Philip Freo, he's also the Anglican Primate of Australia, so effectively the church's leader in the nation. He was speaking to ABC News this morning prior to the report and the final recommendations being released. One of the big issues that we know, and we certainly heard the survivors raising it a lot yesterday, is the progress towards the redress scheme. Archbishop Freer says the Anglican Church is still working through the details of the scheme with the federal government.
But we are eager to see a redress scheme in place that enjoys everyone's confidence. And I know that the scheme that's been brought forward by the government differs in some quite significant aspects from the scheme recommended by the Royal Commission. We've been able to make some representations in areas that are important to us, like the sharing of information so that matters of information that go to a redress scheme can be available back into our church disciplinary processes, because we think that's important. So we're still working in some of those areas of detail. We know that the states are working with the Commonwealth in some areas of detail important for them. But I'm hoping that we'll have worked through those things to have an operational scheme ready for the proposed start-up time in the middle of next year. And we're broadly looking at about March next year to resolve matters of how the scheme operates, so that we'll be in a position of making a decision to participate. But there's still detail being worked through, as you'd expect.
That's the Anglican Primate of Australia, Dr. Philip Freer. Samantha, one of the key findings that we've long known about is the recommendation for a national redress scheme. What's the Prime Minister had to say about that today?
One of the issues that's really emerging with the redress scheme, Kim, and becoming increasingly controversial is the federal government's proposal that anyone who has been who has recorded a criminal conviction against them won't be eligible to apply for redress under the national scheme. We heard survivors yesterday extremely critical of that. The commission over the years has heard from survivors themselves and psychologists who've said a lot of people who've been abused end up having very troubled lives, often turning to drugs and alcohol and sometimes crime. So survivors particularly critical of that move to bar those people from getting redress under the scheme. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, addressed the issue with Neil Mitchell on Radio 3AW this morning.
That's the government's proposal. That's our policy that's set out in the bill. But
is that fair? Because a lot of them will have, part of the reason they'll be in jail has been the abuse they've suffered.
Look, I understand that argument. I understand that argument, but equally, providing you can understand how many people would be uncomfortable with and opposed to people who have committed serious offences, okay, then being provided compensation by governments.
That is the Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull speaking on 3AW, and before him, our reporter in Melbourne, Samantha Donovan. The race is on to secure last-minute votes before people head to the polls in the Sydney seat of Bennelong tomorrow. Campaign teams from the Liberal and Labor parties are out in force. The federal government is desperate to keep the seat, to hang on to its majority in the House of Representatives. Opinion polls are predicting a tight result between Liberal John Alexander and Labor candidate Christina Keneally. For more, I'm joined by our political reporter Stephanie Boris. Stephanie, by-elections are always important, but is there more attention than normal on this one?
Very much so. And that's because it all comes down to numbers. Everything is about numbers in politics. And the reason it's so important, this by-election, is it really will determine how much legislation the government can get through Parliament. So let's talk numbers. There's 150 MPs in the House of Representatives. If Labor's Christina Keneally wins, Labor's numbers would be boosted to 70 and the coalition would actually fall to 75. So it means if Labor could actually defeat the government on a vote if it had the backing of all five crossbenchers, and the government would technically only have 74 votes because the Speaker doesn't actually vote unless there is that tie. So if Mr. Alexander wins Bennelong back, the coalition will have 76. six members and get its working majority back, which is obviously what it wants to do. So taking a look at recent polling that's been coming out this week, we've had a news poll that suggested two-party preferred was 50-50 between John Alexander and Christina Keneally. Keeping in mind, though, it was a small sample they did of about 500 people. There was also a Reach Hill poll with the two-party preferred basis there. Mr Alexander leads Ms Keneally 53-47. So the polls are showing that both Labor and Liberal will need to rely on preferences from minor parties to potentially get over the line. Of course, this is very worrying for the Prime Minister, and he has actually spoken about it this morning on Melbourne Radio 3AW with Neil Mitchell. He says the by-election could have serious implications for the government.
It would reduce the government down to 75 seats out of 150 in the House of Representatives.
What about confidence in your leadership?
Well, Neil, it would certainly reduce our majority. We would no longer have an absolute majority in the House of Representatives.
The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, speaking on Melbourne Radio 3AW. Stephanie, how would you characterise this campaign?
Well, in John Alexander's words, he said this by-election is going into uncharted territory, saying Labor's brought in a celebrity candidate. And obviously that really has shaken things up. Homes have been bombarded with flyers. There's been plenty of robocalls going out from both sides. John Howard has been brought back in. You've seen both Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and Opposition Leader Bill Shorten visit the electorate a number of times. There's been a number also of senior Liberal ministers hitting the ground running and really campaigning for John Alexander. Voters the ABC has spoken to say they're over it. You know, last year they had a federal election. This year there were local council elections. We've had the same-sex marriage vote. And now this. Now, I have to also say, I don't think it's been a very clean campaign. Both sides have been throwing mud at each other as much as they possibly can do to try and, you know, win over a few more votes. The big thing, there's been this big focus on the Chinese community during this by-election campaign. They do make up a large part of the community in Bennelong, covering suburbs such as Epping and Eastwood. Now, Christina Keneally has previously said the government is spreading China phobia, going as far to say the rhetoric is similar to One Nation. Today, she pointed to the proposed citizenship test the government wants to introduce, which requires all immigrants from non-English speaking countries to sit a language test. She was pushed by journalists, though, to provide specific examples of Chinophobia, and this is what she had to say.
Are you not stoking the fires of racism by constantly talking about this Chinophobic rhetoric?
I'm not the one who's brought it up. The Prime Minister has chosen this path. He has chosen to go down this path to put in jeopardy our economic relationship with an important trading partner. And the Prime Minister has chosen to stoke these types of fears.
Senator Keneally, you've repeatedly said he's stoking xenophobia. What language specifically? Can you point us to language?
I don't think
Prime
I've
Minister?
Ever used the phrase xenophobia.
You said he's stoking Chinophobia. Can you point us to specific examples where the Prime Minister has engaged in Chinophobia? You gave us no examples whatsoever.
You
gave us sentiments, Christina Keneally. You haven't given us examples.
I have spoken about the Chinese community's frustrations and concerns. I've gave you examples of the citizenship test. I gave you examples of things the Prime Minister has said.
Christina Keneally there speaking to journalists in the electorate of Bennelong. Now, the Prime Minister has been hitting back against these claims over the past few weeks, and he did so again this morning.
The proposition that my government or I or Australians are anti-Chinese is outrageous. What Keneally and Shorten have been doing in Bennelong is demeaning and desperate.
So, Stephanie, Labor's Christina Keneally has been asked on numerous occasions also about her plans if she doesn't win tomorrow's by-election. Has she made that any clearer?
Well, in a short answer, no. So the suggestion is that she could take the Senate seat left vacant by outgoing Senator Sam Dastyari. Now, important to keep in mind, though, that vacancy can't actually be filled until the New South Wales Parliament holds a special joint sitting next year, so it will remain open for a bid. Christina Keneally has been asked to rule out putting her hand up for the Senate seat if she doesn't win tomorrow. She was pushed again on this today, but wouldn't say.
I refer to the full transcript of an interview I did yesterday on Sky News. It's repeated in The Australian. I've got nothing more to add than what I said yesterday.
Labor candidate Christina Keneally. Stephanie, while the government's got one eye on this by-election, it's also becoming clear that it's about to notch up some further success with that deal to send refugees to the United States. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the ABC has confirmed about 200 refugees on Manus Island and Nauru have been approved to be resettled in the United States. You'd remember this is a deal that was agreed to under President Barack Obama, and it will allow genuine refugees who are currently living on Manus Island and Nauru to be transferred to the US and to live there permanently. So earlier this year, we had the first group of men, women and children go to the US. It was about 50 of them. We've learnt today about another two groups who will be on their way to the US soon. So just over 70 refugees in Port Moresby have been approved. Some were told yesterday, some are being told today. And we also understand there's just over about 130 people on Nauru. They were notified over the last 2 weeks. Now, this process of who gets approved and who doesn't, that is up to the US. They go through the security and medical checks, but we do understand that that number will continue to rise in the months ahead.
That's our political reporter in Canberra, Stephanie Boris. The world's largest entertainment company is getting bigger. Disney is buying a $68 billion chunk of Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox. It's not just a business deal. It means the merger of some big comic book characters, the X-Men and the Avengers. But there are fears from Hollywood that Disney will now have a monopoly on the movie-making business. Angus Randall reports.
The Empire has taken over. Disney bought Star Wars 5 years ago, and now it's set to gain control of movie-making giant 21st Century Fox. Marketing expert Matt Britton calls the amalgamation of Fox and Disney a bonus for viewers.
I think what you're going to start to see is Disney really start to aggregate all these assets, and they've stated their intention of having a streaming service. So I think all these major content houses are understanding that linear television is going to change, that the TV and the computer are going to become one and essentially create a giant iPad hanging on your wall. And in that world, the consumer really is going to have the choice to pick what they want to watch, when they want to watch it, to pick if they want to be exposed to TV commercials or not, and really be addressed to on an individual basis.
Once the deal goes through, Disney will have the rights to major money spinners, including The Simpsons, the Alien franchise, and the upcoming Avatar sequels. James Jennings is the editor of film magazine Empire. He doubts the merger will make a difference to the casual film fan.
My guess would be they'd still keep 20th Century Fox as its own separate thing, and they would still release films under that banner. So to the consumer or to the film fan, you know, they're still getting those films under those banners. And that also gives them, again, the opportunity to release things that might be riskier, edgier, not entirely family-friendly, but still have it under their umbrella, so to speak.
And he's most excited about the possibility of a superhero smackdown. Disney has owned most of Marvel's comic book roster since 2009, including Iron Man, Captain America, and The Incredible Hulk, while Fox has had control over the X-Men, Deadpool, and the Fantastic Four. James Jennings is confident there are plans for a super-powered reunion once everyone's under the same roof.
Marvel fans really want to see all the characters come together. You know, I mean, with the Avengers Infinity War next year, they're bringing together all the Marvel characters. So, like, film fans really love seeing these characters cross over. And it hasn't been able to happen with X-Men, Fantastic Four, and Deadpool because they're all owned by Fox. So now that Disney own those properties, there's a possibility of all these universes coming together. So I guess film fans, Marvel fans, are really excited to see probably some of their favourite characters cross over.
While there's excitement from comic book fans, there are also fears Disney will take a heavy-handed approach to the other franchises it now controls. The company took charge of the Star Wars universe 5 years ago and has already fired four directors over creative differences. James Jennings plans to wait and see.
You know, we've seen with Star Wars especially, it's like, oh, we want to take risks and we want to have younger, edgier directors. And every time they've sort of done that, it's kind of gone skew-iff and they've had to replace them. So it's really interesting because there's obviously a big template for these films. And if people try and break the rules too much, I guess they get shown the door. So what that says for artistic freedom and creativity in the studio system, you know, who knows?
Hollywood writers are unhappy with the merger. The Writers Guild of America West has released a statement arguing it strains competition laws.
Disney and Fox have spent decades profiting from the oligopolistic control that the six major media conglomerates have exercised over the entertainment industry, often at the expense of the creators who power their television and film operations. Now, this proposed merger of direct competitors will make matters even worse by substantially increasing the market power of of a combined Disney-Fox corporation.
Disney's venture into the worlds of comic books and Star Wars has seen massive box office success, but it's had little recognition during the awards season. A Disney film has never won the Best Picture Oscar in the awards ceremony's 90-year history. James Jennings expects Disney will continue to chase that elusive Oscar under the prestigious Fox Searchlight studio.
Niche movies that are made at a much lower budget still have a chance, I think, in the marketplace. And look, the thing is as well, is studios are always going to want that Oscar prestige, regardless of how much, you know, the latest Marvel or Star Wars film is making. There's always that season when all the prestige films come out and they get to hang their hat on the fact that they might be winning an Oscar for a film. So those films are always going to be around. Whether or not there's as big an audience or as big a scope for them to be produced these days is debatable, but I certainly don't think it means the end of them.
Empire Magazine editor James Jennings, ending that report by Angus Randall. To look at the business side of this deal, I was joined earlier by Scott Maddock. He's a portfolio manager for CBG Asset Management. Are you surprised that Rupert Murdoch is selling assets that he's spent decades building up?
Well, yes. I think, you know, the empire has been built up, you know, since Rupert was gifted the opportunity, in a sense, of running News Corporation in Adelaide.
Why do you think he's doing it?
He's a smart guy. You know, I think we've seen the change in the media landscape over the last 10 years. He's reacted to it in different ways. And Disney also is reacting to it. So Disney are trying to cement their position and move on to a new level to deal with changes in distribution, going direct to consumer, which is their new mantra. And, you know, adding more content is obviously going to give people more choice.
Is this the end of an era for the Murdoch empire?
Well, clearly, yes. I mean, how old's Rupert now? You know, we're looking at the third generation potentially actually running the empire by themselves. So particularly James, Lachlan and Elizabeth. They then have to look at what happens for the next generation. And I think the next generation probably isn't going to be involved in the media landscape in any way like the previous one.
If we think of all of the deals that Rupert Murdoch has done over his life, do you think this is the biggest deal of his career?
It is in a monetary sense. This is the seminal change in how we approach the world sense, yes.
He is still going to hang on to assets like Fox News and Fox Sport. From an Australian perspective, do you think there's any future in perhaps of a re-merger that he may merge Fox News and News Corporation at some stage?
Look, it still has to make sense to the other shareholders. Believe it or not. It's not impossible, but I don't see particularly the benefits. I mean, the Murdochs control both entities. You know, it's easy to separate them in terms of responsibilities amongst the family. It's less competition in that sense. So I don't see any particular imperative to do that. But note too that the assets which the new Fox will have are essentially broadcast assets of one form or another. It's distribution, which currently is being challenged by streaming and various other forms. So the new Fox is, in fact, the old Fox.
Does this deal reshape the global media landscape?
To a degree. Disney is in most markets already. It now gets much better distribution in Europe, particularly, and it has the ability to become more relevant than it is in some markets. So, yep, you can get a Disney movie in Pakistan. You're just as likely to want to watch something which was made in Arabia as anything else. So Disney now gets more choice to offer those sorts of consumers.
They're offering more choice, you say, but also are we seeing a consolidation in Hollywood as well?
Yes, because there's a threat. So, yeah, that's when things consolidate.
So this will have a massive effect up and down the movie and television show supply chain.
Absolutely.
Disney has made it clear that it's going to pull some of its movies off Netflix, that it might do the same with some of the Fox programming that's currently on HBO and Netflix and offer them directly to consumers. So are we going to see, do you think, some of these big studios pursue that distribution model, you know, more effectively?
Well, they want to, clearly. That's certainly what they want to do. They want to keep their margin, maximise it as much as possible. And, you know, Netflix has been very effective, but it isn't increasing their margin if they can do the same thing. And there's no obvious reason why they can't, except for incumbency and first mover advantage. Then, yeah, they'll do it. Don't worry.
So technology is really allowing some of these big studios and production houses to get their products more and more directly to the consumer, cutting out all of these middle distribution channels.
Yep. So, you know, now we have a local TV network which delivers, or sorry, we still almost have that, a local TV network which delivers content in various forms now, but still delivers content from the studios. That won't happen anymore.
Scott Maddock, Portfolio Manager for CBG Asset Management. On air through ABC Radio and Radio Australia, streaming live on our website and via the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. And still to come on the program, does air pollution cause teenage delinquency? And artificial intelligence helps astronomers find a solar system the same size as our own.
When we did this, we were mostly trying to prove to ourselves that this kind of technique could work. We wanted to have a proof of concept that machine learning and neural networks could help us identify planets which may have been missed before.
The US has taken the rare step of declassifying missile remnants and putting them on public display to back its claim that Iran was behind a recent missile strike into Saudi Arabia. The US ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, says Iran is supplying weapons to Shiite rebels in Yemen who've been fighting the US-backed Saudi forces since 2015. Iran has dismissed the accusations as a fabrication and accused the US of provocation. Ann Barker reports.
That's the sound of a ballistic missile that Yemeni TV accused Houthi rebels of launching last month into Saudi Arabia, targeting the main civilian airport in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Saudi Defence Forces intercepted the missile before it could hit its target, but missile fragments landed in the airport area and were later handed to the US. Now, US officials have displayed the remnants to media at a military base in Washington, and they say they're indisputably from an Iranian-made short-range missile.
These weapons were supplied by the Iranian regime. The evidence is undeniable. The weapons might as well have had Made in Iran stickers all over it.
Nikki Haley, the US ambassador to the United Nations, says the missile fragments show Iran is supplying weapons to Houthi rebels in Yemen in breach of international law.
The Iranian Guillaume missile is the only known short-range ballistic missile in the world that lacks such stabilizer fins and includes 9 valves that you will see running along the length of the missile. Those valves are essentially Iranian missile fingerprints. It was made in Iran, then sent to Houthi militants in Yemen.
Ambassador Haley says the US took the extraordinary step of declassifying the weapons in the interests of international transparency and cooperation. She says they're proof that Tehran is blatantly ignoring the 2015 nuclear deal with Western powers that bans it from launching such missiles.
Everyone has focused on the nuclear deal. And Iran has hidden behind the nuclear deal, constantly threatening to get out of it. But these are the things they're doing while we're all looking the other way.
Iran rejects the US allegations as unfounded and says the fragments on display are fabricated. Iran's own mission to the United Nations in a statement says the US accusations are irresponsible and destructive.
These accusations seek also to cover up for the Saudi war crimes in Yemen with US complicity and divert international and regional attention from the stalemate war of aggression against the Yemenis.
A Saudi coalition backed by the US has been at war with the Houthis for nearly 3 years since they overthrew the government in Yemen. Iran doesn't deny backing the rebels, but denies it's supplying arms and says last month's missile launch was an independent action by the Houthis in response to Saudi-led aggression. The US President Donald Trump has pledged a much harder line against Iran, and Ambassador Haley says the US will now rally other nations to push back against Tehran.
Its ballistic missiles and advanced weapons are turning up in war zones across the region. It's hard to find a conflict or a terrorist group in the Middle East that does not have Iran's fingerprints all over it.
Saudi-led forces have intensified airstrikes against the Houthis since last week when the rebels killed Yemen's former president Ali Abdullah Saleh. On Wednesday, Saudi airstrikes hit a police camp in the rebel-held capital, killing at least 35 people.
Ann Barker reporting. Over the last couple of decades, thousands of North Koreans have risked their lives to flee to South Korea. But in an unexpected development, a growing number want to return home, saying South Korea is not the land of freedom and prosperity they were hoping for. North Asia correspondent Matthew Carney reports.
In 2014, Kwon-chol Lam fled North Korea and made a perilous journey across China and Thailand to start a new life in South Korea. After 3 years, he says it's been a mistake and now wants to go back.
North Korea is my home. It's where my son lives and parents died. There's no hope living here. I've experienced so much harassment and treatment like a second-class citizen.
Kwon-chol Lam lives in poverty and isolation in a small room in an outer suburb of Seoul. He can't get a job and has no friends.
I'm lonely, and most of the defectors think like this. South Korean people don't want to socialise with us. They don't treat us like human beings.
But he's fighting back. Kwon-chol Lam is one of the first defectors to campaign for the South Korean government to change laws to allow them to go home. Defectors get South Korean citizenship, and that forbids them from any contact or visit to the North.
I have declared myself as a citizen of North Korea. Even though my body is here, my mind is living in my home. My desire to go home is stronger than ever.
There are 25,000 North Korean defectors living in South Korea. Coming from the authoritarian North, many of them struggle to fit into the fast-paced capitalist South. More than half suffer discrimination and depression, and 25% of them say they've considered returning home. Even defectors like Kim Yong-dok, who have been in South Korea for 20 years, made money and raised a family, want to return.
I have strong feelings that I really want to go back and live with my family, because that's where I was born and grew up.
It's a hard road back for North Korean defectors. They live in limbo, ostracised in the South, but also not welcome back in their homeland, where they're used as propaganda and punished. This is Matthew Carney in Seoul for The World Today.
Artificial intelligence is taking over many of the jobs once done by people, and the search for planets similar to Earth is no exception. Machine learning has helped to discover new planets amidst all the data collected from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope. Sarah Seggi explains.
Our own solar system, the Milky Way, has long held the status of the solar system with the most known planets. But the discovery of a new planet in a distant solar system circling the star Kepler-90 has changed that. It's the eighth planet found orbiting that star. Andrew Vandenberg is an astronomer at the University of Texas, Austin, and one of the researchers who found the planet.
This planet is about 30% larger than the Earth. We have measured the orbital period, or the length of that planet's year, and it turns out that the orbital period is about 14 days. So if you were born on this planet, you would have a birthday every 2 weeks. But the downside is that because it's orbiting so quickly around its star, it's very close in, and the planet is therefore very, very hot, way hotter than we would want to be living there.
The planet is one of two new discoveries identified through machine learning from Google and data from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope. NASA's telescope has been searching for planets similar to Earth.
When we did this, we were mostly trying to prove to ourselves that this kind of technique could work. We wanted to have a proof of concept that machine learning and neural networks could help us identify planets which may have been missed before. We think that this has been a successful proof. We found two new planets, Kepler-90i, the eighth planet in its system, like I mentioned, and another planet called Kepler-80g. These planets had never been seen before, until we used our machine learning approaches to increase the sensitivity of our searches.
Is it more efficient than having humans looking for these planets?
Yeah, absolutely. Humans are very good at recognizing patterns and very good at identifying planets, but humans are not particularly fast at these things, and they're not particularly consistent. On two different days, a human might look at the same signal and give different answers as to whether they think it's a planet, just because sometimes the questions that you ask are tricky, and humans might you know, be in a different mood one day or the other and give different answers. With artificial intelligence, we hope to make the process more efficient.
Christopher Chaloux is a senior research software engineer with Google AI and was also behind the discovery.
I learned that actually the Kepler mission had generated so much data that humans were not actually able to search it all for planets by themselves. And so I decided that we should maybe apply this neural network technology to search for new planets. And so I trained a machine learning model to identify these planets in this Kepler data set. And I used this model to search for new planets that were perhaps missed by previous searches of the data.
While the newly found planets are unlikely to host life, there are still many planets in the universe to explore. Associate Professor Elizabeth Tasker is an astrophysicist at the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency.
Whether we'll find a planet that hosts life is a top question. Like, everyone wants to know. And it is a tricky question to answer at this stage. At the moment, what we've got are shadows of these planets passing across their star. So we can say, okay, this is the size of the planet, this is how much radiation it's receiving from its star, but it doesn't yet tell us anything about what it's like on the surface of these planets. However, some of the next generation of telescopes are definitely set at doing this. They're going to start probing the atmosphere of the planets, which will be our first hint about what's actually going on the surface. However, until we start to get a lot of data telling us this kind of information, it's very hard to judge how Earth-like these Earth-sized worlds are. As an example, within our own solar system, of course, we have Earth and Venus, two very, very similarly sized planets that would look very promising as exoplanets. But in fact, the surface of Venus is about 460 Celsius. It melts lead, and the longest a spacecraft has survived on the Venetian surface is less than 2 hours. So until we start to get some atmospheric data, it's very hard to speculate on how common Earth-like conditions are going to be in the galaxy.
Associate Professor Elizabeth Tasker from the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, ending Sarah Sedgie's report. Can higher levels of air pollution lead to an increase in teenage delinquency? A new study in the United States has found that it could affect the behaviour of teenagers living in urban neighbourhoods. But poor relationships between parents and children and a family's socioeconomic status also play a part, as Connie Aegis reports.
Lying, cheating, truancy, stealing, vandalism, arson, and substance abuse. It's behaviour often associated with teenage delinquency.
The adolescent brain is an important developmental period characterised by significant social and biological changes. It's during this critical time that delinquent behaviour increases in both rate and severity.
But there could be an environmental link to this type of behaviour. Dr. Diane Noonan from the University of California says higher levels of pollution can be a factor in this bad behaviour.
Air pollution, when it is inhaled, it's either going straight into the brain and it's causing this neurotoxic effect, or it's causing neuronal death or damaging the neural network, resulting in this adverse effect on behavior. Studies have shown that when you inhale these particles, they can go deep into your lungs and get into your systemic circulation, and they can cause oxidative stress, and that can be damaging to the brain.
Dr. Yunan was part of a team that followed 682 children in Greater Los Angeles from 9 to 18 years of age. The parents monitored their children's behaviour, and the researchers monitored the air quality daily. The results showed 75% of the children breathed ambient air pollution that exceeded the recommended levels.
This was assessed using a parent-reported questionnaire called the Child Behaviour Checklist. It asks a variety of questions related to truancy, arson, lying, cheating, stealing, and so forth. So our study showed that higher levels of air pollution were associated with higher delinquent behavior.
Are there other factors that can come into play here? I mean, for example, parenting or socioeconomic status?
Yes, of course, which is why in our analyses we adjusted for a variety of other factors that could be associated with delinquent behavior, so that we could make sure that what we are seeing is actually due to the air pollution and not to these other factors. After adjusting for factors such as gender, ethnicity, household and neighborhood socioeconomic status, neighborhood quality, and a variety of spatial covariates that are related to air pollution, we still saw that air pollution was having an adverse effect on delinquent behavior regardless of these other variables.
Dr. Yunan says the study supports other research.
What we are finding is consistent with other papers. Other studies have looked at other environmental toxins such as lead and metals and so forth. And they also are seeing that it's associated with externalizing behaviors such as aggressive behavior and delinquency. These studies that did look at delinquency and air pollution were mostly cross-sectional studies. So ours is the first examining how delinquent behaviors in adolescents were affected by air pollution longitudinally over time.
She says the findings warrant further investigation.
We definitely believe that more research needs to be done because this is such a relatively new field. It's hard to just take our one paper and say, okay, something needs to change. We need our results to be substantiated in other studies as well, in other populations and in other locations worldwide. And I think if that happens, then that will influence the policymakers and the government to have tighter restrictions on air pollution.
The study has been published in the Journal of Abnormal Child Psychology.
Connie Ages reporting. Earlier this year, the Fair Work Commission decided to cut Sunday penalty rates for retail and hospitality workers. Employers had argued that it would help create jobs and also give some people the chance to work more hours. Researchers from the University of Wollongong and Macquarie University have now done an online survey of 1,300 workers to find out if that's happening. One of those researchers is Dr. Martin O'Brien, a senior lecturer in economics at the University of Wollongong, and I spoke to him earlier. Dr. Martin O'Brien, in broad terms, what did your research find?
Well, what we were looking for is to see if we could find if Sunday hours had increased, if more workers were working on Sundays, and finally if overall weekly hours had increased in retail and hospitality, which were the two main sectors where the penalty rates were cut earlier on this year. Unfortunately, we failed to find any evidence whatsoever of any increase to employment nor hours in those sectors affected by the penalty rate cuts.
Did you get any clues about why that was?
Well, we did ask some other supporting questions, and one of the interesting findings was that there was between 15 to 20% of workers in retail and hospitality cited that they were unlikely to work there in the coming years, primarily because of the wages and conditions.
So is it a case that workers perhaps were just deciding to turn down the Sunday hours if they didn't think it was worth it?
That's the main finding that we've reached so far, because we didn't find the same type of effect across the other workers in retail and hospitality that were covered by enterprise agreements or individual contracts, for example. Particularly in retail, it was only those workers that received the penalty rate cut that were actually working fewer Sundays, where the same effect was not present for workers on other types of wage agreements.
Employers, of course, had argued that a cut in Sunday penalty rates would lead to a boost in employment and people getting more hours. So are you saying not only were more jobs not created in these sectors, people actually started to work less hours?
Particularly in retail, yes. Well, the whole rationale of the employers, and also that which was supported by the Fair Work Commission, comes down to simple economics. If you make the price of something lower, the demand for it will increase. But something else is obviously at play here. And one of the other things that we think is going on is related to the record low wages growth that we're experiencing in Australia. So the type of demand that's required in retail and hospitality comes from people having, I guess, discretionary money or leftover income. So if wages growth is very low, people are spending most of their money on mortgages and petrol and utilities, electricity, etc. There's not that much money left over. So it's quite ironic that in a sector that's reliant on discretionary spending power, they're actually cutting the wages there.
These penalty rate reductions, though, are still in their infancy. They're being phased in. The full rollout won't be finished for a few more years.
Correct.
Could it be that we just need a bit more time to see if these cuts are actually going to flow through to increased employment or hours worked?
That could very well be the case. It's basically the 1st of July every year until either 2019 or 2020, in particular, different types of awards that the full effect will be in place. And certainly it could be a gradual thing, but I think really what our results show is it's not just wages itself. It's consumer confidence, it's people having spending money. They're the real things that would drive the demand in retail and hospitality, and in turn, the jobs and people working longer hours.
The latest unemployment figures were out yesterday, and unemployment is at a 4.5-year low. It's at 5.4% nationally. About 61,500 jobs were created last month. So perhaps we're just seeing a very good jobs market at the moment, and there simply aren't more people to hire, to put on.
Potentially the case, but... No, I would tend to lean more towards the fact that we have low growth in wages, and it's just not really flowing through to people's consumption power and their confidence, really.
Dr. Martin O'Brien, a senior lecturer in economics at the University of Wollongong. This weekend marks 50 years since Prime Minister Harold Holt waded into the surf of Victoria's Mornington Peninsula and was never seen again. Wild conspiracies about how and why he vanished still intrigue many people, although they've never been substantiated. Tim Lammercraft takes a look.
From the scene of the search for the Prime Minister, Peter Ivanov has just telephoned this report.
The search today was hampered by rain, strong winds and vicious seas.
All manner of theories have been put forward to try to explain Harold Holt's disappearance off Cheviot Beach on Victoria's Mornington Peninsula. Everything from being kidnapped to a Chinese submarine picking him up in the dangerous surf.
Oh, yes, the conspiracy theories that he was spirited. Was it a Chinese submarine or a Russian submarine? I forget now. That was all ludicrous, of course. But, you know, unexplained disappearances do breed that kind of what I think Donald Trump would call fake news.
Tim Bowden was an ABC journalist who at the time was in New York.
Overseas reaction to the disappearance of Mr. Holt has been immediate but cautious. A short while ago from New York, Tim Bowden reported on the American scene.
A complicating factor in this whole tragedy is that due to the fact that no trace has been found of Mr. Holt, world leaders who are anxious to pay tribute to the Australian Prime Minister feel it injudicious to do so while there's still the slimmest chance he may be found.
Tim Bowden recalls the prevailing sentiment within America to the news Holt was missing.
The Americans were just totally bemused and surprised that we could lose the Prime Minister in the way that we did. And in fact, you know, the undercurrent of that was they thought it was distinctly careless because the security procedures surrounding our own presidents, as we know, is extraordinary. And the fact that we could lose ours on a lonely beach in Victoria, it just seemed incredible to them. They just couldn't believe it.
By this time, Australia was well and truly entrenched in America's war in Vietnam. Holt was close to then US President Lyndon B. Johnson and famously reiterated the slogan, "All the way with LBJ." From his earlier posting in Vietnam, Bowden met the visiting Prime Minister, Holt.
He was a pleasant bloke, very affable and got on well with people. When he went to Vietnam to visit the Australian troops, and I was there at that time in 1966, he walked into the aircrew bar at Vung Tau, and they had a Vietnamese barman there they called Joe. It wasn't his real name, of course. Harold walked up to the bar and one of his aides said, "Oh, Prime Minister, would you like a beer?" He said, "I'd kill for one." And they said, "We'd like to introduce you to our Vietnamese barman, Joe." Joe drew himself up to his full 4 feet, 7.5 inches and said, "Hello, Prime Minister, how are they hanging?" Which is how he'd been told you should talk to somebody important from Australia. And Holt said, who like Gorton could never understand anything any Asian said, "What did he say?" And they said, "How are they hanging?" He said, "Christ, I don't know. I've been so busy since I've been here, I haven't had time to look at them."
His body was never found, and a coroner ruling in 2005 found his death was accidental and caused by turbulent waters.
It was an extraordinary moment in Australian life to have a sitting Prime Minister lost, drowned, and it was at a critical moment in international history. And so, of course, we had everybody from the then US president to so many others visit Australia for the funeral. Now it's the time to commemorate the life rather than the loss.
Coalition Minister and local member for Flinders, Greg Hunt, is one of those attending Holt's anniversary this Sunday. Cheviot Beach is in his electorate.
And of course it was a drowning. I know those waters well. Even this week when I was down there, to see that on a calm day, the breakers offshore were, you know, peak to trough 2 to 3 metres with a massive undertow. they are tough, dangerous waters.
Friends, family and fellow politicians will gather for a small memorial service on Sunday to commemorate and remember the country's 17th Prime Minister. Greg Hunt says it will be a time to focus on Mr Holt's achievements while in office that include an end to the White Australia policy, recognition of Australia's First Peoples and the appointment of Australia's first female minister.
So he was a great Australian, just a great Australian in terms of women, children and Indigenous Australia, and an approach of ending the White Australia policy, one of the most significant social leaders in the last 100 years.
The Federal Health Minister and the Member for Flinders, Greg Hunt, ending that report from Tim Lammercraft. The tiny town of Warrabra in South Australia's mid-north is about to be left without a school. After 138 years, the primary school is closing today and locals are worried about what that might mean for the town's future. Patrick Martin reports.
It's a drizzly, overcast morning and Year 4 student Hannah Woodlands is working in the garden at Warrabra Primary School. So what are we doing out here today?
Picking berries.
How long have you been picking berries for at the school?
Whenever they're ripe, which be probably every year around summer.
But today's harvest is the last. With only 11 students left, the school is closing down. 8-year-old Tegan Hollett is disappointed the school board has voted to close it down. Her relative, Josiah Hollett, opened the school at its current site in 1921.
And I feel very cross because the parents who voted yes to close it down because they didn't have enough money to pay for the school to be open.
The remaining students, including Crispin Harness, will have to go to other schools in Laura and Boolaroo Centre, both a 20-kilometre bus journey away.
I haven't been here very long, but I've made quite a bit of friends and I'm sad because I like this school and I don't want it to close.
Teachers are sad too. Jane Mainprize Potter came from England to begin her teaching career at Warrabra. Her career took her to other schools, but she returned this year to take up the principal's job and oversee the school's closure.
Quite sad in the sense that I had really good memories of the school when I taught here in 2005. And so to see the numbers decline to the stage where the school was going to close was pretty sad.
And she knows the closure will be felt by the whole community.
I think the students have realised that because of the numbers it was inevitable, but they have been really sad. But they're also quite pleased at going to the new schools and making new friends. So it's sort of a bittersweet experience.
There are plenty of memories too for former students like Kevin Sizer.
Proximity of the church to the cricket pitch on the oval was such that there were some lads capable of heaving a ball through the church window, which was one of the targets.
He says the school's closure is a serious blow to a town still recovering from the 2014 Bangor bushfires.
It's just another nail in the coffin of small country town. We are a declining population, we're an ageing population, struggle to encourage young people to stay, young families to move in. If you haven't got a school, it's just going to make it a whole lot more difficult.
Across town, convenience store and post office owner Vicky Morley says business owners are trying to remain positive.
It's never good for a school to close, but it's progress. Unfortunately, there's just not enough children to keep the school open. However, the parents still have to bring the children in to catch the bus to go to whichever school they're going to. So I don't think it's going to impact on us a great deal.
The state government says it's working with the local tourism and development group to allow use of the garden and kitchen at the site until it's sold. Warrabra locals would like to see a new caravan park or movie theatre built using the old school facilities. But any future plans will depend on how much money can be raised for the projects and who buys the site.
They've been very proactive in trying to work out what to do with the school. You know, the main thing is that the children don't suffer.
Warrabra business owner Vicky Morley ending that report from Patrick Martin. And that's all from the World Today team for this week and this year. I'm Kim Landers, the program's executive producer. Today's program was produced by Michael Edwards. Associate producer is Barney Porter. Research by Flint Duxfield. Technical production by David Lawford and Kem White. Digital production by Laura Briley Newton. And web publishing by Amelia Tan and Sandra Orr-Prince. Dominic Schwartz and the PM team will be along this evening. And don't forget Saturday AM tomorrow.